Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, hello, and welcome back to a Tuesday afternoon edition of the Chase Thomas podcast. I'm still the aforementioned Chase Thomas, and it is Tuesday, so that means Major League Baseball with Fangraph's own John Taylor is what we'll be talking about on this very podcast. John, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Doing good. Coming to you from very hot Chicago, Illinois, on this fine Tuesday instead of New York.
I think it's hot everywhere right now.
It's probably hot everywhere. It is July. July does tend to be a hot one.
I saw the numbers in Vancouver and just what's happening there, and people literally dying from the heat. It is it's not good, John.
Yeah, I mean, this is the world we live in. To start things off on such a positive note,
to be fair, for the listeners, you've been seeing the check my notes here: Detroit Tigers and Pittsburgh Pirates as of late.
Yes.
So I mean, that's kind of been your MO.
That'll raise your spirits no matter when. I saw that not only did I see the Tigers win, but I also saw an inside-the-park home run from Eric Haas, who is not the kind of guy built to hit an inside-the-park home run. So, really, two miracles in one day.
Are you a scorebook guy?
I am not a scorebook guy, no. I am when I'm working at a game. I'll keep score, but otherwise I'm not.
Interesting. Do you find that you're less engaged without the scorebook?
No. I mean, yes and no, because it can be kind of easy if you're just there as a fan to just kind of forget what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But especially if you're focused on, oh, I want to go get a beer or a hot dog or whatever it is. But no, I find even when I'm keeping score, sometimes shit just distracts you. And especially if it's Pirates or Tigers baseball, you know, your brain is kind of telling you, you don't have to pay attention all the time.
Especially when you're beating the Braves 11-1, that's also a good reason to look away and to not engage and not be all the way invested, John.
Yeah, the Braves aren't doing too great right now, are they?
Hey, Orlando Arcia, he's coming. He's back in, back out. Jason Kipnis getting some reps in for the Stripers down there in Gwinnett. Things are fine.
God, I forgot that those two were on the Braves.
Oh, you want to see some, remember some guy stuff, go check out the AAA Atlanta Braves, or Gwinnett Stripers, rather. It is it's a classic, oh, that's where that person is list. It's a fun thing.
But in a depressing way, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, you got to see PNC Park, which is definitely on my baseball bucket list. Did it live up to the hype?
Yes, I highly recommend it. So what I really like about PNC is it feels like the best minor league stadium you've ever been to. And I genuinely mean that as a compliment. It's got great sight angles. It's comfortable. It's just a really well-built, well-designed, well-everything park. Highly recommend if you are a person who is all about the baseball stadiums, check it out. If you haven't gone, make a point of throwing it on your stadium bucket list. It's very nice. The weird thing about PNC, there's nothing like special about it. You know, there's some parks that have like special things. You know, Fenway's got the Green Monster, Wrigley's got the Ivy, Yankee Stadium has got every guy named Joey in a 5 mile Tri-City radius. But like, PNC doesn't really, the thing PNC has is just being there with the view, and not only that, but I think it's about, I think it's mostly just about the experience of being there, because it's just such a positive experience all the way around. You know, you walk across the Clemente Bridge to get to the game. You sit and you have this, if you're facing the outfield, you have this great view of downtown Pittsburgh with the bridges and the buildings. It's, you know, things there are reasonably priced. It's never, I mean, it's a Pirates game, so it's never going to get particularly overly crowded. It's just a really good time. It's a really good baseball time. And I just highly recommend, you know, if you've never been to PNC and you can get to PNC at any point, get to PNC. It's a really good time.
Interesting. Okay. I mean, I'm glad that it actually lived the type, because Camden, PNC, Comiskey is, I don't know. I'm happy that it's still called Comiskey is the main thing.
It's guaranteed right field now.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it has been for a couple of years. Remember, we all made fun of it because the guaranteed rate has that downward facing red arrow.
Oh, fuck. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm glad we still talk about it as Comiskey and just bypass the advertisement on the front of that. I'm glad we're still doing that.
Yeah.
Although, go ahead.
I was like, while we're talking stadiums, I also want to throw a shout out to Comerica in Detroit. A very solid stadium, very Camden reminiscent. Another one with really good sight lines.
What makes you think of Camden there?
Just the design, just the way it's laid out, the emphasis on brick, the kind of the feel that it is like a retro park, which is of course funny for Detroit because they had a huge retro park in Tiger Stadium that they tore down. But I think the only thing with Comerica is, and I didn't experience this because I sat a little closer to the field, but I've heard the seats up in the 300s are kind of far away from the action, a little bit hard to watch. But otherwise, it seemed like Comerica was also just a very solid park with a very kind of good vibe to it. I like Comerica a fair amount.
Hmm. Interesting. What's next on the tour?
I'm going to go to a game at Wrigley tonight, but Wrigley's already been crossed off my list just because I can. So next stadium for me that I've not been to and will be seeing for the first time will be whatever Miller Park is now called. American Family Fun Insurance.
National Mall of America Field.
The Jeremy Burnett's Memorial Stadium, basically, where we all gather to celebrate the life and times of Jeff Jenkins.
I was going to say Jeff Jenkins was the other one who we were going to throw in there.
You know, who the ultimate remembering a brewer is? John Jaha.
Oh.
Real.
Hmm.
Real 90s Brewers vibes right there, early 2000s.
Yeah. There you go. Deep cuts. Are you ready for this day in baseball history, John?
Yes.
Today, July 6th, 1958, yes. John. A day after he walks outfielder Willie Kirkland with the bases loaded to give the Giants a 5-4 victory, Cardinal reliever Larry Jackson hits Jim Davenport with the bases full in the ninth inning to again force in the winning run. Is that... can you imagine being that reliever? Back-to-back nights? Like, how do you lose in back-to-back? Which fan base would react the worst to something like that?
Yankees, because they're the worst fan base in the world. But I gotta imagine for this guy, he comes out there, he's like, well, at least I'm not gonna do that again.
Right.
or not even that, actually. Because I don't know what the full play-by-play of this was, but did he come into this game with the bases already loaded?
I don't know, it didn't specify.
Or did he load the bases? Did he load the bases in both scenarios?
I'm gonna guess
he did.
Or was
this something where he was... Okay, well then as he's loading the bases the second time, he's got in the back of his mind, he's gotta be thinking, are you fucking kidding me? Like... we're not doing this again. I almost like the idea of him hitting the dude instead of just like ideally with the first pitch and be like, screw it, let's just get this over with. I don't want to go through this again. And just plunking him and being like, I want to go home. I've had it with this week. We've all had that moment where something's going wrong. We just say screw it and put our foot to the gas and just lean all the way into it being a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's that I can't imagine that feels particularly good.
Yeah, it's called bartending in your 20s. You just, there's, you get into it, and you just, there's some nights, man, where you're just like, oh, this is how this is going.
Yeah, you're trying to make a martini, you pour rum instead of vodka, and you're like, fuck it, and you just pour in the vermouth along with it, and you just make a rum martini, and the next thing you know, you do not have a job anymore.
You haven't lived until you've bartended a concert, like a Jimmy Buffett concert.
You
haven't lived.
You say you haven't lived, I say I would rather die. Just push me in front of a moving train, and I will just, that will be my choice instead.
I'll never forget those memories. Leave the memories alone. The Blue Jays are reportedly coming back to Toronto by July 30th with a superstar coming back to Toronto.
Welcome back, Blue Jays.
That's good. I'm happy. That's good.
Great.
When you look at, like, when I'm watching the highlights and I'm watching like the 7-minute gamers for the Jays in the morning, and I'm looking at the stadium, I'm like, ah, this is just weird. I'm tired of it. Like Buffalo, I like that Toronto and Buffalo work together and this kind of thing, and that you get to split the fan base a little bit and get some Toronto fans and get some Buffalo fans and increase the Blue Jay footprint, but you got to get out of that stadium. That stadium sucks. Like, that is a boring minor league stadium.
And something I'll be genuinely interested to see is, and I think some of this is a little chicken and egg, you know, some of it's the greatness of the Blue Jays offense, and some of this is also the badness of portions of the Blue Jays pitching staff, but both Dunedin and Buffalo, those stadiums rank 1 and 2 in terms of runs in park factor this season. They also rank very highly in home runs. Those are offense first stadiums, and that kind of makes sense. Dunedin is a little bit of a bandbox. It's a Sally League stadium or a spring training stadium as well. It's very clearly not up to major league standards. It's just kind of basic, and I'm with you. Buffalo is just kind of a bummer. But those stadiums have played very, very offense-friendly, the two most offense-friendly stadiums in baseball so far. And
what's the other one?
Well, Dunedin and Buffalo, so where they started the season and where they've been playing since. Rogers Center is not an offense-suppressing park, but the last time we had a full season's worth of games there back in 2019, it ranked right around average for runs. So I'll be really interested to see what goes with the Blue Jays' offense and pitching once they move back to Rogers Center. I got to imagine, obviously, there is the home field advantage, finally, again, of being able to play in Toronto again, of having fans there, especially in Dunedin, they're always, in that part of Florida, there are a lot of transplants. Buffalo, of course, is not an established major league city, although I have to imagine the Blue Jays fan base is a little stronger there. But still, there's no different, or there's no comparing playing in two minor league stadiums versus playing at home with your home crowd in your home country. You know, so, but I think the interesting thing for me would be see, can the Blue Jays offense, or how much was the Blue Jays offense helped by Dunedin and Buffalo, and how, if at all, are things going to change once they come back to Toronto? But otherwise, of course, you're really happy to see it, really happy for Blue Jays fans. They get to see that team again, especially because that team is really can hit and actually really is. I mean, I know they're quite far back in the AL East race right now, but with George Springer back, and I think if they make the right moves pitching wise, definitely a team that's going to be part of at least the wild card conversation, if not the AL East conversation for the rest of the season.
Yeah, I think so for sure. Sixto Sanchez, unfortunately, is down for the year. John, your reaction? Oh, and also, hold on. This is incredible. So before, like, I am staring out my office window right now, and as I was concluding, the Blue Jays talk. A Blue Jay literally just flew into my window. That was the coolest thing.
That's freaky.
Oh my God. This is weird.
Blue Jays are winning the World Series.
What else could that mean, John?
I think that's what we know what that means. Blue Jays win the World Series.
There you go. Okay, but anyway, Sixto Sanchez.
Yes. Sixto. I'm not surprised. I mean, I think his impact was going to be minimal regardless, given that he'd already had a setback in his rehab. More likely than not, we weren't going to see him until August in the first place. Obviously, it's a hard blow for the Marlins. He's super talented. He would have been a nice boost to a pitching staff that right now is good. I mean, Alcantara, Rogers, Lopez, I think we talked about it last week, is, you know, you can make a case that's the best top three in the National League. Or if not the best top three in the National League right now, maybe the three that you would most want going forward, aside from what the Brewers have got. But the problem they've run into is that aside from maybe Zach Thompson, who's made a few starts and has looked very good, they don't really have much pitching behind that. Both Sixto getting hurt and Eliezer Hernandez really hurt them in that regard. I mean, the bigger problem for the Marlins is, one, they have their offense is pretty much non-existent aside from Starling Marte and Jesus Aguilar, with Jazz Chisholm chipping in, Adam Duvall decent off the bench, but that's pretty much it. Second, they're already dead last in the NL East. They're 9 games back of first. They're 11 games under 500. Their Pythagorean's way, way better, in part because they have some of the best pitching in baseball right now, but they cannot hit. It's too hard to rely on winning every single game 2-1, 3-1, 4-3, whatever it happens to be, because you can't score, especially when the Marlins bullpen is fine but not great. We've seen Yimmy Garcia come back to earth a lot. They've gotten some good work out of Dylan Floro and Richard Bleier, but there's not really a guy there you trust to be that kind of strong setup reliever or closer to kind of lock down those kind of narrow leads you have. I mean, I don't know if Sixto would have been a potential option there if the Marlins had decided there wasn't enough time for him to get stretched out as a starter, but maybe he could be an impact to any reliever. Obviously, that's not going to happen now. And I don't think it's a nail in the coffin by any stretch for the Marlins, but I also don't think that this was a team that – it's almost like the Marlins didn't need a nail in the coffin. They've already been buried, you know. And so Sixto not coming back just makes it less likely that they're going to thrust a skeletal hand through the dirt and climb back out of it, to take that metaphor to its ghoulish conclusion.
Yeah, we talked about last week. It's interesting that, like, yeah, there's so much upside and we want to watch him pitch, but, like, they still have a trio of arms that are more than capable of getting the job done. But the Marlins, do they still have the number one run differential in the NL East as of this recording? I want to say they do.
I'm not sure. I mean, the run differential right now is they're above water by 21 runs. So I'm guessing that if they don't have the number one run differential, they're probably one of only, I'd say maybe the Mets probably have also a positive run differential. I'm checking right now because I'm genuinely curious if the NL East continues to be the stupidest of all divisions.
Yeah.
No, the Mets are 7 runs above and the Braves are 6 runs above.
Okay.
The Marlins really have just been, in part, they've been terrible away from Miami. They've been really bad against above 500 teams, I think in part because they just don't have the offense to hit the kind of pitchers they're seeing from those, especially in the NL East when you have to deal with DeGrom and Scherzer and we'll sub Max Fried in there, Ian Anderson and Aaron Nola. There's a lot of really good pitchers, Zach Wheeler. There are a lot of really good pitchers in that division that are just a problem. They had a really bad month of June, and they're terrible in one-run games, if you want to point to the Marlins' biggest problem, that's it right there in terms of just how it is. With a pitching staff like that, you have to, and an offense like this, you have to win the one-run games, and they're 8-19 in those. So I think you can probably place a lot of that blame on the offense and the bullpen that are just not doing enough to make those. I mean, look at the fact, too, that on the Marlins, and I know wins and losses for pitchers, that's obviously not a way to judge them, but I'm not using to judge them, just to point out. Pablo Lopez, for example, has an ERA under 3 and 4 wins. I mean, that's in 17 starts. Sandy Alcantara has 5 wins in 18 starts. You know, this is, again, it's more a reflection on the team behind them and how much they've just left these guys out to dry, I think, than it is anything on the pitching side for them.
Yeah. The Marlins are going to be so weird to forecast over the next couple of years. I don't know what to make of them.
They got a very strong farm system. I think for them the interesting thing is going to be when they get into the deadline, assuming they are still near the bottom of the NL East and have decided, okay, there's no real future in 2021. You know, they have some veteran guys they can try to flip for some prospect help in Aguilar, in Miguel Rojas, the most interesting one would be Starling Marte. Mm-hmm. I know they made, supposedly the Marlins made him a long-term contract offer, but only for 3 years and $30 million, which I can't imagine he's going to accept. I do wonder if they're doing that, both leaking that offer so that people know they tried, and also trying to get that done to get an idea of whether or not he could be in their plans going forward. And if he isn't, he would make a very, very attractive trade piece for a lot of teams as a rental, who ideally wouldn't cost too much, but bring speed and power and, weirdly enough for Starling Marte, a newfound emphasis on drawing walks. So I think that's going to be the big question for the Marlins over the rest of this month is, you know, who do we move if we decide this is over? And particularly is Starling Marte a guy we move, if we're convinced that he's not going to be part of the next good Marlins team, which is also its own question because Marte is 32, you know, you can definitely expect better from the Marlins next year if everyone is healthy, I just don't know if you can expect better enough that this is a team you can confidently predict is going to finish above 500. I know I had them as a dark horse team this year, but dark horse for a very good reason. I thought that that wasn't necessarily going to be the end of it anyway.
Yeah. Which also brings us to the other Marte on the Diamondbacks. Cattell Marte is not going to be moved per the Arizona Diamondbacks. Are you surprised that they are going to hold on to Marte this past the deadline this year?
No, because I figured if I don't know what the future holds in Arizona. I know we've talked about they have a very good farm system as well going forward, and that the major league team doesn't really have a lot of pieces kind of to move off that are of any real value, so to speak. I definitely think that Marte is a dude you end up building around, though. He's only 27. He'll turn 28 in October. And he is signed very cheaply both through next season, honestly, through 2024. He's got team options worth a combined $18 million in 23 and 24 with very low buyouts if for some reason things go terribly wrong. So you're talking about a guy who's only owed about $26, $27 million over the next 3 years, who's a 28-year-old who can play the infield and the outfield, who's a very strong hitter, who is, he's not running as much as he was in the past, which is a little confusing, but, you know, still a very good hitter, a lot of good power, you know, just a solid player. And I think if you're Arizona, that's kind of what. No, this is kind of our foundational piece right now. Maybe if things continue to be this bad next year or 2022 as well, or sorry, 2023, then we can discuss something else. But no, I think it makes sense for Arizona to build around him now. And I also don't necessarily know that Arizona wants to tear it down because, like I said, this is a team with a good farm system right now. They're not in a position like, say, Baltimore 3 or 4 years ago where they had a bad farm system and just needed to start stockpiling it with talent. You know, I think this is more what you're going to see with Arizona is instead of a guy like Marte being moved, even though he is hurt right now. And I think that's also probably part of it is that he is hurt and that's going to affect his value. You're more likely not going to see, okay, is there anyone out there who's interested in Isdrubal Cabrera and Eduardo Escobar and maybe David Peralta and any other veterans who are either toward the end of their contracts or who might have a fair amount of money owed to them going forward. I mean, the problem there is the guy with the most money owed going forward is Madison Bumgarner, and there's no one on earth who's going to trade for his contract. So that's an issue. But yeah, I think it makes more sense for Arizona to target moving guys like Escobar and Cabrera, even though you're not going to get much of anything back for them. But I kind of have a hard time seeing how this team is made better, essentially, by trading Cattell Marte when they already have a farm system that's good enough right now.
Yeah. I think that they could also just look at it as, like, we could be the Giants next year, where things go our way next year and the Giants come back down to earth and we can flip things. And I don't know. I also just wonder, like, yeah, it's just such a tough division now for the next couple of years. Like, the Dodgers and the Padres are not going anywhere. It's just going to be – they're going to need a lot of luck, and they're going to need a lot of BABIP luck in the future. And
they are, and I think if you're a team like Arizona, you can get some heart from how the Giants have gone from being bad last year to all of a sudden being not just, you know, top of the division, but legitimately top of the division. But on the other hand, even if the division is kind of a pipe dream, because like you said, the Dodgers and Padres aren't going anywhere, and it seems like the Giants have figured out at the very least some semblance of contending functionality. Like, I think the big thing for Arizona is, okay, the wild card is still an option, though. Even if one of the Dodgers or Padres is probably part of that race as well, the threshold for that is at least a little lower if we're thinking maybe it's, it only takes 88 wins to take a wild card spot as opposed to 92-plus to win the division. You know, maybe that's something they can aim for. I mean, I think more likely than not what we're going to see from Arizona next year is kind of a gradual rebuild back toward contention because, again, a lot of the good prospects they have are not close to the majors at the moment. So I think, you know, obviously that's last season hurt them in that regard because there wasn't enough development for those guys. So I can imagine that next year's Diamondbacks team will probably be more, hopefully not as bad as this one, but I can see it being kind of in a similar vein of maybe something more Mariners adjacent, the kind of flirting with 500, but, you know, realistically not a team that's going to contend as it tries to kind of figure out what the next iteration of contention looks like in Arizona, because it's pretty clear to me that guys like Marte aside, the Diamondbacks team that was supposed to contend on the backs of Bumgarner et al. Is not really going to happen. And I think it's probably time for that franchise to retool a little bit around Marte and around the prospects and just kind of figure out a different path going forward.
Yeah, I agree. How do you explain Kyle Schwarber, John Taylor? How do you explain this? Like, I watched the entirety of the Nationals. I'm already blanking on who they were playing. They were beat. Oh, the Rays. Like, I watched a lot of that series in Schwarber. And the top of that lineup, and, like, the Nationals are just a team. I'm like, they should be good. Like, I don't know why. Like, we were talking before the season where I'm like, I think this is still, like, if things go the right way, like, I don't know how they shouldn't really be in the NL East race late in the season. But how do you explain Schwarber? Because it's wild to watch, John. He's hurt now, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, he's hurt, unfortunately, so it's not something we can really figure out now as to what he's doing. He ain't doing shit right now. I think a lot of it was, as a leadoff hitter, he was just seeing more strikes, because I do believe generally leadoff hitters do tend to see more strikes than non-leadoff hitters, so that probably had a lot to do with it. You give Kyle Schwarber fastballs in the strike zone, he's going to do what any hitter is going to do, or at least any power hitter is going to do, which is, you know, put a bat on him. Some of this, I think, is just simple luck. You know, he had a home run fly ball rate of like 60% amid this super hot streak. Mm. You know, that obviously is not something you can count on to continue. But, I mean, this is Schwarber's always had this kind of power and this kind of potential, so I'm not really surprised we're seeing it even in this kind of Bonzian burst. I mean, the other part of that is anyone is capable of that Bonzian burst. I remember Brian Daubeck used to do this on the regular for the Red Sox back in the day. Mm. There'd always be two or three weeks of every season where Brian Daubeck just went completely insane at the plate. Mm. Obviously not to this exact level. What Schwarber is doing was historic. But I don't think it represented some new... I'm really going on a limb here. I don't think Kyle Schwarber is a guy who's going to hit 120 home runs in a given season.
Can we roll it out?
I know. Really, really a big gamble on my part to say that. But I do think a lot of that was a combination of just some good batted ball results and good batted ball luck, combined with the situation that let him just get a lot of fastballs in the strike zone, which... I mean, Kyle Schwarber's had some struggles offensively, but he's good enough a hitter to know what to do with that.
Yeah, I think so. Do you think the White Sox are a good fit for Adam Frazier? We talk a lot about Frazier and Cabrian Hayes at the top of that Pirates order. Do you think that makes sense? That's a partnership that makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think ever since Nick Madrigal went down, that's definitely a team that needs second base help. I think they've been mostly trying to get by on the likes of Danny Mendick and Leury Garcia and kind of whoever else they can plug into that space, and that's just not going to do it. Those guys are not. They should not be regular players on a contending team.
Also,
I mean, the good news.
Going
I mean,
down
the good
just
thing
sucks, man. Like a
yeah,
freak injury.
That's really wrong.
And he's different. The diversity
yeah,
of
like
him. Like he's a different kind of player. Baseball needs guys like that to be healthy and playing.
Yeah, we need those guys who hit 320 because they just make contact all the time. The David Fletchers and Luis Arraez of the world. But, I mean, the good news for the White Sox is unless Cleveland is somehow for real despite having no pitching staff and a terrible offense, I don't think they need to worry about second base over the course of the season at large. They'll be fine with whatever they do. I think the reason to get a guy like Frazier is, one, to give them that depth and that floor in case, you know, because there's no guarantee Garcia or Mendick hangs on. And once they're gone, I mean, those are already bad internal options. What do you do if they go down or if they continue not to produce? You can't just have a zero in the batting order every single day, no matter how defensively useful they are. So I think a guy like Frazier, like, one, gives them a much higher floor at second base. Two, gives them a tougher lineup once the playoffs do come around, because either Garcia or Mendick are automatic outs in the postseason. Three, he lengthens the lineup a bit, too, because he is a guy who can make contact, he can get on base, you can put him up near the top of the order and have him do some damage. Ostensibly, you could put him near the bottom of the order, as you did Madrigal, and kind of give yourself a second leadoff hitter if you really want to. I mean, this is a team that has struggled to find a number two hitter. They've used 11 different guys in that space this season. Mm. Most of it's been Adam Eaton, who is both hurt and not good. The next two guys, Luis Robert and Madrigal, also hurt and not available. Behind that, Brian Goodwin, who's been good, but it's not a guy you really want to count on. So I think if you were to get Frazier, you kind of easily slot him into that number two spot. Stabilizes the lineup, means you don't have to bat Eaton high in the lineup. You don't have to worry so much about Leury Garcia and Danny Mendick soaking up at bats. They can kind of go back to utility roles where they're way more useful as pinch runners, as backup, as defensive replacements, and as guys you can just, because you know Tony La Russa is going to do this at least once in the playoffs, as a guy you can pinch hit and get down a bunt. I'm so excited for him to pinch hit someone to bunt in the playoffs. It's going to make everyone lose their damn minds. But yeah, I think it would make a lot of sense for Chicago. And I also don't think it should cost too much. I mean, Frazier is not a guy who, you know, beyond, I mean, he's useful, he's got his skills, but he's 29 years old. He is only under team control for another two seasons, I believe. Yeah, he'll be a free agent after the 2023 season. He's not making much right now. He's only making $4.3 million this season. He'll get a nice little bump in arbitration next year, but he shouldn't still cost that much trade-wise. And the White Sox are a team that does have some guys who maybe they could get the Pirates interested in, Lala, Jake Berger, Zach Collins, kind of guys who are a little closer to the majors who haven't really produced but might still have some surplus value for a Pirates team that really more than anything is just focused on getting cheap team-controlled talent and trying to see if they can kind of, again, if they can turn on Jake Berger or Zach Collins into the next and ideally more valuable Adam Frazier down the road. Mm. It's kind of a cynical way to be, but hey, that's the Pirates. I don't really know why you'd expect any different at this point.
I guess they didn't know how you felt about them, and Charrington didn't peep you at PNC Park. Cause I would,
yeah, I don't know. I sent him so many messages.
Mm-hmm.
Be like, Ben, my man, mm-hmm. come on down to section, whatever section I was sitting in.
Mm-hmm.
Let's crack some Iron Cities.
Yeah.
Let's get some dollar dogs.
Uh-huh.
You know, let's figure out the direction of the Pittsburgh Pirates.
What if spent more money? And he's like, all right.
Yeah, I mean, granted, yeah, it would have been a very short conversation, mm-hmm. Which would have been awkward because those Iron Cities are very big. But yeah, Ben Charrington, drop me a line. Ben Charrington, come on the Chase Thomas podcast to talk about Pirates with me. Debate me in the octagon of ideas. You coward.
I don't see how he could say no.
Yeah, let's throw metaphorical hands, Ben. Figure this out.
Wellington Castillo officially retired. What is your lasting Wellington Castillo memory, John?
I don't know if I have a lasting Wellington Castillo memory aside from always calling him Beef Wellington because, well, I mean, you saw Wellington Castillo. He was built like a refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I remember him being on the White Sox the last couple years and just kind of hanging out. Obviously, he was the pre-Wilson Contreras Cubs catcher that everyone kind of thought would be, oh, maybe this is the future, and then he very clearly wasn't, and then just kind of bounced around the league toward the back half of his career. I don't know. I mean, he was a league average hitter all said and done when it was all said and done. So that's, you know, he had his value, certainly not a good defensive catcher. A guy I figured would go to Japan or Korea maybe and try to lengthen out his career a little more, you know, instead of just hanging around AAA or whatever it is. But I mean, I can also understand that, you know, if you're a guy who hasn't really had major league success or been able to kind of stick on a team for a bit, you know, you're in your 30s, mid 30s now. You've had a decently long career. You don't really want to relocate all the way to Japan or Korea just for maybe a shot a year from now at getting an invite to spring training. So I can understand why Castillo might be like, you know what? I've had a good run. Now is my time to call it a day. So congrats to Wellington Castillo. Congrats to anyone, honestly, who makes it to this far and has, you know, Wellington Castillo put together a 8-year major league career, something along those lines. Like he played 2,700 he played 700 games over 10 years as a major leaguer, got 2,700 plate appearances. You know, that's a solid career. It's certainly nothing that really anyone's gonna ever look back on aside from when he becomes part of the roster of guys to be remembered as he is now. But hey, congrats to Wellington Castillo, man. He hung around for a bit and he had himself a nice little career as a bat first catcher.
Last thing before we wrap up with your Boston Red Sox, John. The Yankees reportedly are very comfortable going over the luxury tax this season. Is it for pitching? What do you think they'd do to push them over the tax prior to the deadline?
One, I'll believe it when I see it.
Mm.
That they're willing to go over the deadline. I don't think they actually are. Two, I don't know what you do with the Yankees. I've thought about this a fair amount because this team is a mess. This team is a flat out mess, and it's not just a mess but also an inflexible mess where you have a lot of pieces. Like, for example, I think one of the best things the Yankees could do to improve things right now would be to move Gleyber Torres off shortstop, admit that experiment just has not worked, it very clearly has not worked on either end of things for Gleyber, put him back at second base. Problem is, one, what do you do at shortstop? And maybe that's something where you go, oh, well, you put Gio Urshela at shortstop and you move DJ LeMahieu over to third base, which I can't imagine is the best defensive alignment, but maybe that works. Mm-hmm. But also, what do you do then with – what do you do with – I just think this roster is like you have too many kind of locked bats like Stanton and Voit. You know, I think also if you were to, you know, if you were to think, okay, what's the big move the Yankees can make that would make the most sense for them that would fix – a fair number of their problems would be you go to the Rockies and say, what do you want for Trevor Story and John Gray? Mm. Problem is, well, then what do you do with Glaber or Urshela or LeMahieu? How do you figure out that infield that's already too crowded as is? So I don't know. I mean, I think if you're the Yankees, I think the move that would be the most sensible is some combination of a pitcher and a hitter, either a middle infielder or some outfield help, particularly center field oriented now that Aaron Hicks is done for the season and that Brett Gardner just really has not been able to, he just looks done at this point. And granted, left field's also an issue with Clint Frazier, but, you know, that's a team I think too, where if for example, the Marlins were to make Starling Marte available, I think that's a guy the Yankees should be very interested in. Unfortunately for the Yankees, the Marlins don't really have an extra pitcher they can staple into that deal in terms of a veteran guy who can help. But yeah, at the end of the day though, this is a team that's now barely above 500, has never really looked at any point during the season, except for a brief stretch in May, like a contending team or like a functional version of the team they're supposed to be. And I think it would be, if this continues on like this and we get to the deadline and the Yankees are still a few games over 500 and, you know, somewhere between 6 to 10 games back of the Red Sox or whoever else in the AL East, I think it's going to be pretty easy for the Yankees to say, look, like, there's not one move that's going to fix all of this, but we're going to try to tweak the roster to make it better. And that's their way around, you know, having to go over that luxury tax. So I just don't see them making that big move that would necessitate really going over the tax, because I just don't see how how can they make it, especially if they want to offload money in the exchange. There's not really anyone on this team making money to such a degree that you can comfortably move them. No one's going to take on Giancarlo Stanton's contract as it is. You know, you're not going to be able to offload what you owe.
Wait, are we sure? Braves, sign it up. We have an opening in left field. Do it. Let's put him in right, whatever. Move Acuna around. I'm here for it.
Incredible challenge trade right there, Giancarlo Stanton with the Braves.
They can have Drew Waters, Christian Pache. I don't care.
That's going to be a really interesting thing to follow, I think, in the offseason, is whether or not the Yankees just say, try to figure out some way to just say, you know what, it's not working, and just move Stanton. I'm really curious to see if they've decided that after, like, and he's been good, and I don't think Giancarlo Stanton is anywhere near the Yankees' biggest problem. He certainly hasn't been. I mean, it's annoying that he's had his usual injury issues and hasn't been able to play the full season so far, but when he's been on the field, he's produced. You know, he's hit for power, he's been an above average offensive player. You know, his time in New York, he's had a 132 OPS plus in his New York time, and it's been 131 this season. He's been good. I just wonder if the combination of contract and positional inflexibility leads the Yankees to decide we can't really, like, doesn't matter how good a hitter he is. He'd have to be it's not quite the JD Martinez, and that's the thing. Like, I think, I guess it all just comes back to the decision theoretically that the Yankees had of trade for Stanton or sign JD Martinez. Because, I mean, the Red Sox have something similar with Martinez, but he's obviously under contract for much less time, and he's hitting even better. So, yeah, I don't necessarily – I'm not predicting anything. I don't know anything. I have no clue how the Yankees feel about Stanton. But I wouldn't be surprised if, coming off this season where they've really been laid bare how kind of inflexible this roster is, if they start trying to get rid of some of the pieces that have made it that way. And I think Stanton is one of the biggest ones there, because he really just doesn't play the outfield anymore. And paying $30 million a year or whatever it is to a DH only, who is good, but who is not hitting, you know, he hasn't been Nelson Cruz or JD Martinez. I don't know that that's something that, even for a Yankees team that prints money, that's a hard thing to work around, I think. Not just salary-wise, but also roster-wise. It is just a locked spot that you can't really do anything about.
John, last thing, we'll wrap up here today. How excited are you for the long, thin king, Chris Sale, being ready to go sooner
always,
than later?
Always excited for that absolute lunatic to return. He's gonna go way too hard post-Tommy John surgery, you can already tell. But in reality, it's really – I don't know what they're going to get out of Sale this year. A lot of it's going to depend on how quickly he can get through whatever rehab he needs to do in terms of starting. I'm skeptical that because of the timeline of the amount of time left in the season, he's really going to be able to get stretched out enough to do anything more than make a few starts if that's the route they choose to go.
Mm.
But it really would be helpful because this Red Sox rotation is very sketchy. You know, if it stays healthy and semi-productive as it has been so far, it's actually been a productive rotation despite all the kind of hiccups. Fine, but one injury and this team is in really, really bad shape. They don't really have the depth to survive any injuries, nor do they really have the depth to survive, for example, Garrett Richards continuing to try to figure out how to pitch without sticky stuff or anything like that. So it's really good depth to have back, I think, similarly to Tanner Houck getting healthy again. I'm just skeptical as to how much of an impact Sale is going to be able to have because Tommy John rehab is unpredictable, and he's only going to have a short period of time really to get stretched out and back into shape in terms of being a starter. So I'm not expecting big things, but if nothing else, it is an option. I just hope it's an option that the Red Sox don't use as an excuse not to make a deal to be like, oh, we've got Chris Sale but coming back from Tommy John. That's as good as any trade. It's like, no, because he's coming back from Tommy John rehab. You can't guarantee how that's going to work. So you need to add some depth beyond him. But I will always be excited for my thin lunatic king to return and huck sliders painfully.
Hmm. All right, John Taylor. Well, we'll have to see how it all goes. I'm not having a good time with this Pirates series with the Braves. You get to experience, though, Shohei Ohtani on a nightly basis right now. That's cool.
Ooh, it's fun.
That is fun.
Happy birthday, Shohei.
There you go. Go subscribe to Fangraphs.com if you have not already. It's a great website that you should go read every day. And go do that. Follow John at J.A. Taylor. Follow myself at Chase_Thomas, and also read my work in sportsrenaissanceman.substack.com that I'm doing, moving it over my writing from the website to that Substack page, so go check that out if you have not already. And, you know, leave us a 5-star rating and a review on this Apple Podcast platform if you are an Apple Podcast listener. John, we will be back next Tuesday, as we always are. Will you be back in the homestead?
No, I'll still be in Chicago next Tuesday after a brief trip to Milwaukee. So we'll talk some All-Star break from Chicago. All-Star stuff should be fun. We'll be fresh off the Derby. We'll be fresh off the joy that will be the Shohei Ohtani home run Derby. So that'll be very fun.
There you go. John Taylor, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.